right, well, starting things off.
Thank you.
There was a concept that was kind of introduced by Teilhard three-quarters of a century ago about the emergence of new levels of existence, that mankind is really and truly different from the animals because he does function on this higher level. Teilhard spoke of phase transition as an example or a parallel. But the general idea that there is part of human existence which is not accessible to the language of science, not there by experimentation or observation, but something higher, I think is a very real part not only of Catholic theology, but the way life really is. The science does go so far, but it doesn't cover a lot of what it means to be really human. And I'd like to hear the various speakers kind of respond to that theme with regard to their particular talks today about kind of where we're going beyond that transitional level above the animals and where the human really is better, different, and more than just the world of science.
Yeah, I agree that there are limits to empirical science and what it has access to, and there is reality that is not accessible to empirical science. And we have all these qualities which have emerged in the course of our evolution. I would respond with the question, what is significant about this? Is it what we have become in the sense of has some distinct entity like the soul or some distinct capacity? Is it that something like that, something relatively, at least mentally tangible, come into existence? Or is the important thing the value that what we are capable of has? So are we talking about things, you know, aspects of reality, you know, things, and groping for the right term here, that maybe you get what I'm getting after, that have come into existence, or is it that that our abilities and our acts have taken on a value in our own eyes, in the eyes of God, whatever? Is that the important thing to emphasize? I'm just sort of trying to put that distinction out there as something that's maybe relevant to your question.
Okay, I guess it's my turn. It's interesting that as people have heard me speak about the process of human evolution and the expansion in evolutionary theory that emphasizes a process of by which the envelope of adaptability and resilience and plasticity may be increased, may be broadened. Biology has not had very good models about that, but I think that this idea of adaptation, an actual material process of adaptation to variability in the environment that essentially favors the existence of a brain that is capable of taking in so much information and being responsive to it, and developing a language that represents an extra somatic outside of the body means of transmitting information to one another. And that has, as I've mentioned in my talk, kind of a liberating quality that colleagues and theologians and others have come up to me and said, that sounds like Teilhard. That there is transcendent, that there is within the process of biological evolution a means by which one can envision transcendence. People have said to me, well, as an evolutionary biologist, Rick, how can you possibly explain the wonder of a Mozart, or the wisdom of Solomon, or the intelligence of Einstein. And while all of those individuals, in a sense, represent people who kind of go beyond the norm. And so how can evolution, phrased in the traditional way of adaptation only to past conditions, okay, past things, that tethering of an individual and of a species to something that was in the past, possibly generate the creativity and transcendence of human possibilities? And I think that there is a material process that is beginning to become part of evolutionary theory that helps to explain this transcendence. And I think that what Teilhard was doing, as I understand, as I recall his reading, which I did when I was 15 years old, that he was trying to understand humanness as the process of transcendence. So I think that, again, there's area of connection between a process of evolution that is not just a tethering, not just a matter of genetic constraint, but actually is a process of decoupling and increasing the degrees of freedom, to use a statistical phrase, of humanness from, you know, in relationship to the world around us.
There's one thing I'd like to say about my reading of Teilhard. I've always been impressed with this little simple idea of complexity consciousness, that as you look at it, the evolutionary process over, let's say, the last 3 billion years, that there's been an increase of creatures with an increasing complexity of their nervous system and of their consciousness. And although, as far as I'm see, scientists are very hesitant to think in terms of teleology, that de facto, in the cross-section, you do start out with simple cells and end up with people like ourselves. So that somehow the teleology is there, even if it's not. There's an article called Teleology Without Teleology. And so I think we are moving that way, however that's to be explained. And the other thing is that the next level, Teilhard de Chardin sees the omega point, Christ's omega point, as being love. So we already have the noosphere, we already know a lot of things, whereas creatures below us didn't have that level of consciousness. And then I remember reading about communism. He said the Soviet system, the communism, is a wonderful ideal. Everybody is brother and sister to one another, comrade to one another. But the Soviets said it's by outer force. He says, no, the next level of consciousness will be by inner attraction. So there's a wonderful optimism and hope in the thought of Teilhard de Chardin, which I personally share.
Actually, I don't know that I have more to say, except that I think that the distinctiveness in the moral life is the ability to reflect and to articulate why one does what one does. And as far as we know, that doesn't exist elsewhere. Now, as to the scientific aspect of it, I'm not so equipped to respond to as to, you know, is this something that has just flowed out, or is there some kind of an intervention that permits or that equips human beings with this? My understanding is no, there isn't, but that's the distinctiveness of who we are today in terms of our moral action, our ability to analyze, respond, and even articulate why we respond the way we do.
This is a question for all four of you guys. Dr. Ponce, you talked about your own research in showing that climate and environmental fluctuation came around the same time that humans evolved, modern humans, and that perhaps that, I hope I'm saying this right, allowed humans to escape the constraints of changing environments. And in that sense may have been a forerunner to, you know, all sorts of things human, right? And then we have the story of, in Genesis, of the fall. And it seems to me that part of that story could be interpreted as we lived in an ecological paradise, and some decision was made that turned us away from that. And it's almost as if in our free will, we also have the ability and the capacity to turn against God and against creation. And we see that manifested today in our actions. You know, we really are connected ecologically to the rest of the planet, life on the planet. And I think that Dr. O'Neill, you mentioned something about that even competition comes out of mutualism, right? That seems almost more fundamental than the competition that's associated with natural selection and a neo-Darwinian view. So, you know, one reason I think why it's important not to throw out, you know, original sin, that whole myth, that story, is that there may be deeper truths there, right? And that if we throw that story out, we throw out those other deeper truths, which may be our connectedness to the rest of creation and how we can engage in destroying that. So anyway, I just wanted to ask your opinions.
Oh my, I'm holding the microphone. The role of contingency and it all. One of the things that let me just respond, I can't respond to all of that, obviously, but one of the things that I can say is kind of a response to the other talks that I've heard and I've deeply, deeply appreciated, and it relates to the matter of whether, you know, to what extent we embrace or reinterpret the concept of the fall. So much that I hear as the starting point in theological reflection is that sin and wrong and evil is the original condition. And at the same time, I've heard in all of the other three talks hints of a slightly different perspective to take on that. And that is that to what extent is the starting point actually a tension between, and I kind of wrote this down here, so between selfishness and cooperation, a tension between wrong and virtue or good, a tension between baseness and transcendence, and that cooperation and virtue or good and transcendence are also part of the original condition. That there are parts, yes, there are parts, and that means that there can be breakage, but you only have parts because there are also wholes that are coexisting with parts. And I just wonder what the theological implications of reframing it in terms of the tension between those two sets of things are, as opposed to just starting with the point that it was all originally bad and we needed to somehow life needed to make it good. And so it's not exactly an answer to your question, but it's part of my own yearning. I think that's quite parallel or convergent on your own.
Carl Rahner actually answers your question because he starts out with what is called the supernatural existential. And his thought was precisely Dr. Pax's thought, that it's wrong to think that everything is negative and that we start from there, that everything is positive, that everything is grace, and that we, all humans, have, according to theology and according to revelation, I would say, are ordained towards the life beyond this life, and that would imply grace, and that would imply then a very positive thing, the opposite of this negativity. And Carl Rahner says in his writing that that must apply to everyone, and not just those who might get baptized or something like that, so that we all have this orientation towards life with an infinite divinity, and how can we cross that bridge from here to there? So we all talk about the need for grace, and that will be part of it, but that we all have that, and we all have the grace or the opportunities, the wherewithal, to arrive there. And so however that's to be detailed theologically, I think that is the reality, it's one that we experience as well.
Just the one point that I wasn't clear on is I heard what you said initially about, you know, perhaps we lived in an ecological paradise, we can turn from God and others. And then you said, but if we throw out original sin, I haven't really heard the idea of throwing out original sin here said as much as is there another way to express that same truth. So that the truth is that we do make choices turning away from God and from and against creation. So I guess one thing that I was thinking about is the danger of self-deception, that we would pretend that we're not doing these things, that we don't have a role in some of the whether we're going to call them physical disasters or whatever, the danger of self-deception that says, oh, this is completely free from me.
There's a gentleman up there wanted to say something.
Yes, Father O'Neill, I was intrigued by your discussion of the morality of mercy and of solidarity. I've taken a course in the teaching company on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics by Father Brzezinski at Fordham. I understood what he was saying in terms of personal morality, the four moral virtues, prudence, justice, temperance, fortitude. I understand the theological virtues, but this is the first time I've ever heard of solidarity and mercy as a moral obligation on Christianity at large. I could see it as a counsel of perfection, as Christ said to the young man, but it's the first time I've ever heard of this kind of all-embracing solidarity and all-embracing mercy on a collective level in my lifetime, and I had 8 years of the nuns and 8 years of the Jesuits. So I would really appreciate it if you could reconcile Aristotle, the cardinal, the theological virtues, and what are these new virtues?
I don't know that I can reconcile them because I probably don't know enough. But I just think that part of this comes from my own work in recent years of offering retreats based on the words of absolution and reading a lot more about mercy. And I was particularly struck by the description of mercy as entering into the chaos of another, which I think is inadequate, but it captures something of what's there. What do you do once you do enter into the chaos of another? So I'm not sure that I'm not pushing any other virtues aside or anything like that. John Paul, in this encyclical, speaks of Jesus as mercy incarnate. So it's that he embodies this. Now, is the question as to, in terms of speaking of them as mercies, or I mean, I'm sorry, as virtues?
An obligation on Christians to observe them as a positive duty, in a moral sense, rather than as a counsel of perfection.
Well, I'm not sure that I would even begin with that as a way of obliging Christians to some virtues and counseling them to others. I mean, I think that the fundamental invitation in the moral life is to respond to the love of God by embodying in our own lives as much as possible the life and example of Christ. So I don't think even in that regard I would start even with the cardinal virtues. I mean, they're certainly appropriate, but my starting point would not be, okay, you've got an obligation to do these, and if you've succeeded there, then move to the next step. I wouldn't even approach it that way, to be honest with you.
I think that from my reading, there's a scientific basis for a much more than materialistic viewpoint. I'm very impressed by findings in neuroscience, mirror neurons, and I've especially been reading Dr. Dan Siegel, who's a professor at UCLA School of Medicine in interpersonal neurobiology. But I've heard other people in this field say that the mind is not in the brain. The brain doesn't contain the mind. And Dr. Siegel himself studies Buddhism and gave a retreat with a noted Buddhist teacher, and really has a mystical perspective, although he is very much a scientist who writes and teaches science. So I'd like you to comment on that.
Yes, I mean, I would say that there is, it's hard for most people to wrap their minds around the idea that chemical signals between material neurons leads to all things that we think and all things that we ponder and all things that we don't know about. And I think that part of the mystery that needs to be addressed on this is the fact that we think of our brains as this organ up here, but our brains are incredibly social. We live in our minds are social, okay? And our brains just don't belong to ourselves. They are these things that over the course of our lives, especially our young lives, have this developmental aspect to them where neurons, and especially their dendrites, the ways in which they connect with one another, proliferate and then die off. And our experiences as individuals help to then basically do some of that culling of what sorts of circuits are there and what ones stay plastic throughout our lives. And so I think that part of it's hard to be, even though mystics often tend to go off by themselves, it's hard to be mystical if you're not aware of everything else around you, and that includes your social universe. And I think that part of the ways of connecting the material basis of thought and the connections between neurons and the sense of us, that there is something much more than just that, is by understanding that larger context in which our brains develop. And that is a relational matter. That is a matter of relationship to individuals, individuals to the world, individuals to the cosmos. And that relational aspect of the mind is, I think, where I would draw a sense of trying to wrap my mind around the origin of the things that are mystical and that my brain by itself cannot explain.
I have a question for Dr. Cox.
Is this a diversion into something silly? Maybe silly. I think that I have read recently that our genetic code today carries traces of the Neanderthal, suggesting that at one time we coexisted and interbred. Is this a fantasy, or is it just something I remember from when I dated Tom?
That's not silly. That's what dreams do you have? No, I'm kidding. No, in fact, there is a Neanderthal genome project, just as there, that's parallel to the Human Genome Project. Actually, the Human Genome Project was officially declared ended in 2003 with the sequencing of a single human genome. The cost of that was $5 billion. It's now gotten down to the point where within the next 2 years, the sequencing of any person's genome in this room will get to about $1,000. And that is the origin of personalized medicine, whereby we actually have an ability to look at the relationship of our genes to our health and disease risks and things like that. It turns out that out of a series of fossil Neanderthal bones, some of them actually do have DNA that has been extracted from them, that is shown not to be contaminant DNA from bacteria and breakdown of bone and things like that, but actually is Neanderthal DNA. And there is then a unique Neanderthal genome that is beginning to be available that can be compared with the human genome. And it turns out that all human genomes bear traces or evidence of interbreeding with a different lineage of archaic humans. Africans show it within Africa, but it also is the case that within all non-African people living today, all that should be in quotes because there's only been people from four different areas or three different areas of the world that have been tested in this regard, but Asia and Europe and their descendants, bear about 2% Neanderthal DNA in them. We don't know what the functions of those would be. Most of it are fragments of genes and fragments of duplicated elements in our DNA. But what it does show, and there's something called the molecular clock, whereby you can take the frequency of genetic variations and trace them back to when they occurred. And it looks like that degree of interbreeding occurred about 60,000 years ago, which would have been right with the first populations that were dispersing out of Africa, of our species, that is, of Homo sapiens. What it turns out is that there is no evidence of any interbreeding in the, say, 10,000 years of overlap of Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis in Europe. So it does suggest that, and does follow the fossil evidence, that there are different lineages, but different lineages, different genetic lineages that are very closely related can still sometimes interbreed. There are only Neanderthal, uniquely Neanderthal genes in the Homo sapiens genome, but there are no uniquely Homo sapiens genes that have been found in the Neanderthal genome. So how that happened, we don't quite know. But a small amount, a very small amount of mating could have resulted in the 2% fragments of DNA of Neanderthals in non-Africans. Again, is this a matter for us for reflection here of a blurring between humanness and almost humanness? Those are some of the things one might think about.
When you say 2%, is that 2% of people have them or 2% of each individual?
2% of each individual has Neanderthal DNA in non-Africans.
I was just wondering, Claude Wimmer kind of references this in talking about Dee Chardin's discussion of the Omega, but do any of you have any postures about where we're going as a humanity, as a people, as Homo sapiens?
The global village. I think it really is the answer. We're becoming more and more aware of each other's needs. And as was said by several speakers, the emotions are very, very important. Bernard Lonergan, in talking about the essence of a conversion, says it has to be at the intellectual level, at the moral level, and at the religious level. When he talks about the religious level, he really talks about the emotional level. So I'm very hopeful. And I look at the world and I see we're making progress.
If I could just quickly reflect also, there is some idea that what we live in now is a new era of biological evolution and geological change called the Anthropocene. The Pleistocene has disappeared, and the time now exists on Earth where no matter where you go on Earth, you cannot go anywhere that is untouched by human beings. And I think that this is a very profound thing for all of us to think about and reflect upon. It gets back to the earlier question about was there an ecological Eden, a unique place, a paradise, so to speak. There has never been, at least from our understanding of the geological record and the climate record, anything like an ecological paradise, some unique condition. Instead, what we face now, I think, is something where we will face our own severe survival challenges as a species. And that's due to the fact that we don't live on an Earth that has an inherent original condition that now only human beings are changing, but rather what we've learned through the environmental sciences and studies of paleoclimate is that we live on an Earth that is inherently unstable and that it has periods of stability, but also periods of great instability. Human beings are the new experiment in that. How we are adaptable is by modifying our immediate surroundings. And it's become such a successful way of life from an evolutionary standpoint that humans are everywhere, and that's global change. And so what we have then are ways in which humans now are pulling upon the strings of instability, or that caused instability in Earth's environments in the past. And I, as a paleoanthropologist, I look back and the deep human past is rife with extinction. And I think this draws a real question for all of us in the modern age, in today's age, as to how our activities, how our own humanness will change the Earth in a way that actually will rebound on us in ways that could be quite detrimental.
And are you hopeful as Dr. Wimmer is?
I'm hopeful because I also see that there's never been a single species as adaptable as human beings, that we have, through our our plasticity, our adaptability, we are the first species to even be able to contemplate what it means to be extinct, as well as what it means to be human. Maybe there's hope in that.
So I'd like to ask Daryl a question. It was actually brought up to me by someone else at lunchtime, but I think I can more or less accurately pass it on. And it's the whole place of the basic Christian doctrine of incarnation in your presentation. Traditionally, one might say, for example, following St. Anselm, that the sin against the infinite God was something that couldn't be satisfied by finite human beings, and that was one way in which we answer the question, cur Deus homo, why did God become man? Now, in your presentation, at the very end, you spoke of salvation involving rejecting the ancient law of natural selection that made us human, transcending it to follow the selfless example of Jesus. And I'm just wondering, how do you see the notion of divine savior fitting in there? A fervent Buddhist would probably say that Siddhartha Gautama was the most selfless person who ever lived. A fervent Hindu might say that of Ramakrishna. So where does the notion of divine savior sort of correlate with everything else you spoke of?
Well, of course, it's worth starting off by asking what is it we need to be saved from? We say conventionally, well, it's from sin, effects of sin. But you know, if sin is something that has come out of evolution, the ability as well as the inclination to commit moral evil, and if this inclination is deeply built into not only our genome but our societies, then it's something that is problematic to get rid of. And I think it would be wrong to say that it would be easy to get rid of. We're in this Darwinian rat race, basically, driven by natural selection, which I would identify with the what Paul says about creation groaning to be liberated from the futility of it all, which doesn't seem to have a way out of it. And then Paul contrasts this with the saving action of Jesus, of course. As I said, that Jesus shows us a selfless alternative, which he goes through in the Gospels in some detail, say, with statement after statement about how, as I would read it, we should put aside the law of natural selection and do the opposite of, you know, casting out the unfit, that sort of thing, to be more compassionate, more merciful, more in solidarity with each other, and this sort of thing. So one way of looking at that for me is to say that we couldn't ever have come to the conclusion on our own through this Darwinian history, that doing it any other way was at all a viable approach to existence. You know, some philosopher might have thought up the idea of perfect altruism or perfect selflessness, but, you know, the consensus of humanity would have been, oh, come on, that's not possible. That's unnatural, which it is. So you could say that, well, if there was any place in our history where we needed divine revelation or divine intervention, it is at that point where we get to the limit of what Darwinian evolution can do for us. And so we need a deus, maybe not ex machina, but ex wherever, to come down and show, no, it is possible. Here's a human being, an incarnate human being, who has actually modeled for us a selfless way of existing, you know, giving his life in as a natural outcome of challenging the established order. And at least since then, certainly, we have seen many martyrs all over the world in throughout history that have been killed in the way Jesus was for doing the kinds of things that Jesus did. So that's a natural outcome of the process. But so is it literally true that only through divinity coming into our world we can have revealed to us the real practical possibility of being selfish, selfless, or at least approaching asymptotically some kind of perfect altruism, or Gautama Buddha, or other examples in history of religious leaders who, maybe with a different theology, have said similar moral things, that we have to, you know, stop being attached to material selfishness and be compassionate to all sentient beings and things like that, that are very convergent with things that Jesus said. From a practical viewpoint, wherever we get the idea, whichever tradition tells us those things, I think those are the things we need to hear and follow. Now, the uniqueness of the divinity of Christ, that's another whole big theological issue where I'm probably not qualified to tread any farther than I have. So maybe I'll pass this down to the...
not to me.
This is a question that I expected, and as I think it's generally known that there are at least two models of why Christ became human. One was to make satisfaction for us, on the idea being that an offense gets its value from the person being offended. If God is offended, then the offense is infinite, and satisfaction gets its value from the status of the person doing the reparation, which again needs to be infinite because the offense was infinite. So that's why I think the Anselmian idea was that it needed an infinite human being to undo the sinfulness of an infinite God. Now that's one view. But the other would be the Omega point of Teilhard de Chardin, where the incarnation is viewed not from that point of view, but in terms of the fulfillment of creation, that Omega is Christ as divine, is human and divine, is the bridge from this world to the eternal. And that's sort of the model that I personally follow, that within the New Testament, there are a number of effects of the presence of Christ in this world, and redemption might be one of them. But there's transformation, there's sonship, there are all these other leading qualities. I think God is now seeing more from the future, drawing us onward, than in terms of making up for wrongs done.
I couldn't help that.
The time is up, I'm afraid. People have to go home.
Thank you.
All right, one last question. No, it's time.